Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Lee Smith about Guests on Earth. Her 14th novel traces the events leading up to the death of Zelda Fitzgerald in March 1948. After a fairy tale girlhood and a wild and cosmopolitan decade as the young wife of the well-known writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, Zelda increasingly struggled with schizophrenia. Hello everyone, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Lee Smith about Guests on Earth. Her 14th novel traces the events leading up to the death of Zelda Fitzgerald in March 1948. After a fairy tale girlhood and a wild and cosmopolitan decade as the young wife of the well-known writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, Zelda increasingly struggled with schizophrenia, going in and out of mental hospitals, especially Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, where she died in a fire that killed 9 women locked inside a ward on the top floor. Through the experiences of Zelda and the other patients at Highland, Lee Smith explores what constitutes craziness and how our concepts of insanity and appropriate treatments for it change over time. Although Zelda's death is the focal point of the novel, her story is told from the perspective of Evelina Toussaint, who enters Highland Hospital as a patient in 1936 at the age of 13. She is the eye of the passage that follows. Chapter 1. For years, I have intended to write my own impressions of Mrs. Zelda Fitzgerald, from the time I first encountered her when I was but a child, myself, at Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, in 1937, and then a decade later during the several months leading up to the mysterious tragedy of 1948. I bring a certain insight and new information to this horrific event that changed all our lives forever, those of us living there upon that mountain at that time. This is not my story, then, in the sense that Mr. Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was not Nick Carraway's story, either. Yet Nick Carraway is the narrator, is he not? Is any story not always the narrator's story in the end? Therefore, I shall now introduce myself as humbly and yet as fully as necessary, so that you may know who is telling you this tale and why it has haunted me all my life. We must strike up an acquaintance, you and I, if not a friendship, as perhaps the circumstances of my early life are dark and bizarre enough to put you well off that. Enough, as Mrs. Carroll used to say, rapping on my fingers with that pencil above the ivory keys. We begin, then. My name is Evelina Toussaint, a romantic name, is it not? A courtesan's name, which, under the circumstances, was fitting, though not, never, for me, myself, a slight ratty sort of child with flyaway hair and enormous pale eyes that made everyone uncomfortable. Then as now. I am at present a thin, bookish sort of person whom you would never notice if you passed me in the street, which you will not. Yet I was always my mother's child through and through, my mother's beloved child, her only child, her helpful little right hand, as she called me. Lee Smith has won the Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the North Carolina Award for Literature, and a Southern Book Critics Circle Award. And now, let us welcome her to New Books in Historical Fiction. Lee, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for your interest in Guests on Earth.
It's a wonderful book. I'm really looking forward to talking about it with you. Please start by telling us something about you, where you grew up, how you became a writer. You've got a long list of novels to your credit and some short story collections, and even, I think, a play. So tell us something about you.
Okay, well, I was lucky enough, I should say, to grow up in the deep hollers of the Appalachian Mountains of Southwest Virginia. But when I say Virginia, the place where I grew up, Grundy, Virginia, bears no relation to any image that's going to come into your mind when I say Virginia, because there were no columns, for instance, in the county, except on the Presbyterian charge. And very, very Appalachian, very close to Hazard, Kentucky, and Harlan, Kentucky, and entirely a coal mining town, which was very remote and hard to get to when I was growing up there. I was born in 1944. So I have to say, when I was young, I just was so surrounded by relatives, and everybody knew it. You couldn't do a thing and get away with it. And so I was just dying to, you know, to get away. But later, I would, in short order, realize that I was hearing, had heard the best stories that I would ever hear in my life. And once I got to college and started seriously writing, I realized that very soon. I was lucky enough to go to Hollins University in Roanoke, Virginia, and that was a place that at that time did have a terrific undergraduate writing program, which was very, you know, very hard to find. I didn't even know they had it. I just went there because my cousin liked the college, and she got a husband, so I thought, aha, I'll go there. But it turned out that I had always been a really serious reader and a really serious writer, and that was just like, you know, falling into heaven for me. I was writing always as a child. In fact, I think I really started writing because I wanted to write more and more onto my favorite book so that they wouldn't be over. So I was always writing more chapters onto The Secret Garden or whatever it might, Johnny Tremaine, whatever it might happen to be, Heidi, and including myself, I should say, in the plot. So I was addicted to writing and reading very seriously, very early. Though I would write several novels before I was able actually to use the wonderful Appalachian stories and material that I had gained from growing up there, because it was a while before I could figure out how to do that, because it's such oral storytelling, and it was a long time before I could figure out how to write dialect without making it sound like hee-haw. And it was a long time before I would read enough Faulkner to understand that I could have multiple narrators telling the story of a whole community and so on. But I finally was able to use the, you know, because meanwhile, while I was writing other things and having children and working on newspapers, I was recording my family and our family friends in the mountains every chance I got and learning as much as I could about early life there. So at last I was able to write what I think of as my Appalachian books. One of them is named Oral History. It's based upon a witch tale, and it tells the story of one family in one holler for, you know, four generations. And then another one is Fair and Tender Ladies, based on one of my favorite ballads. And this one, I think, is the one that has sold and sold and sold over time. And I know 11 babies that have been named Ivy for the main character there. And I wrote that to honor the hard lives of all the mountain women in my family and the women that I grew up around. I mean, women who had to just keep on keeping on and had little education and too many babies, but were, to my mind, heroic. And so I'm real proud of that book. The Devil's Dream tells the whole story of country music through one singing family, the Bailey family, based to some degree upon the Carters. I used to go hear music at A.P. Carter's store growing up. So anyway, this is my where I come from and my roots. I've written a lot of more contemporary short stories, I think, several collections of stories. I've done a real oral history of my town and my county, and have written several more contemporary novels. But I'm really drawn to to history. I love the research, always, and it's very hard for me to stop researching anything and actually start writing because, you know, you keep going and you find one great remark that has just got to go in there and something else that you didn't know about. So it's like an addiction, too.
Yeah, I think it is. The research is the most fun for me, too. I saw from the video on your website that you write all your novels out longhand on yellow.
I do. I do. I mean, I know people look at me like I'm crazy, and anyone who has seen that video, particularly young people who have seen that video on my website, are just horrified that I'm still writing by longhand. But, you know, that's how I started out. And even when I was taping people, I was always taking notes. I was always writing longhand. And so it seems to me that it just helps me because I'm not a writerly writer. I'm much more of a storyteller, and stories always come to me in a human voice, whether it's the voice of the main character or the voice, because I used a lot of first-person narration because of being a kind of a storyteller. I like to let them speak for themselves. And to me, it's like I hear their voices in my ear, and I'm just kind of writing it down. I'm like the ghostwriter somehow in between. And I don't want any mechanical thing between me and the story, between me and the narrator. And sometimes, of course, if I don't have a first-person narrator, it's just the voice of the story itself. But I think to get it down, I'm interested in people. I'm interested in the human heart, the human voice. And I just don't want anything between me and my people, you know. So I start out that way. And then eventually I, of course, go through many revisions, at first on the typewriter and now on the computer.
I see. No, I think everybody has his or her own way of doing things. I was just interested that that one was yours, and you've answered my question, which was what it is about writing out the story works for you.
Well, you know, I think it's true, too, though, for all writers, that there's a great deal of magical thinking involved with each new project, and you think, can I do it? Can I do it again? And you tend to do it the way you did it before. It's just like the guy who thinks if he sits in a certain chair and wears a certain sweater that Duke will win the basketball game.
Right. Your website also mentions that Guests on Earth is the book that has been waiting for you to write. What drew you to this story in particular?
Well, I go way, way back. I have to say that I am the kind of writer who I think I go through life sort of storing up images that, you know, things that strike me, strike that writer nerve. I think, you know, we're all like this. I mean, there's something that will hit us and, you know, something that will be very striking to us, whether it's an image, a historical fact, a line of dialogue, a song, or whatever it is, that you know somehow there's a novel there, a story, you know, whatever, a remark, and you know there's a story there. And I think as the months and years pass, if that doesn't go away, if in fact it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, you know that sometime you're going to write that novel. So this was the case with me. And I have to say that I have a very personal link to this novel, The Last Girls, because it is all, I mean, to this novel, Guests on Earth, because it is all set in Highland Mental Hospital, Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, quite historic itself, and a sort of state-of-the-art hospital, mental hospital during its time. And my dad was a patient there in the late 50s. And then decades after that, my son Josh was a patient there for 2.5 years in the late 80s. And he was schizophrenic. And so I have to say that I know that place. Place is not very important to me as a writer. And I know that place like the back of my hand. And I really understand, you know, what happens there. And I was visiting there so often, especially when Josh was a, you know, was there. He was there both in inpatient and outpatient situations. He actually graduated from high school, got his degree from high school there. He was a jazz piano player downtown some of the time when he was well enough, and so on. I really know the place, and I became fascinated with the historic and horrific fire which had happened there in 1948, in which Zelda Fitzgerald died, along with eight other patients, women, who were locked in a locked ward on the top floor of the one building that burned. And they were there, they were locked there on, in that ward for their own safety because they had all had insulin shock treatments that day. And when they awakened, they would be disoriented, maybe wander out, who knows what, and a nurse was checking on them. So it really was for their own safety, but it was one of the most horrific hospital fires to ever happen in this country. And it, you know, it fascinated me because it was set, and it was a mystery as to who had set it, although there were some pretty good theories. And so I was fascinated by this. I was also, as a writer, even as a young girl, always fascinated by Scott and Zelda, especially Zelda. And so I learned everything I could about the fire, and I learned everything I could about Scott and Zelda and their relationship. And then there came this one image, which was indelible in my mind and led to me writing the book. You want me to tell you what that is?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
The image. Okay, well, the hospital occupies an entire mountaintop in Asheville, North Carolina. One mountaintop over, the next mountain is occupied by the equally famous Grove Park Inn, which is where Scott Fitzgerald would always stay when he came to visit Zelda while she was in the hospital. But anyway, on the Highland Hospital mountaintop, my son and I once were walking up from the town of Asheville up to the hospital, and the hospital with this very interesting collection of buildings, it looks almost like a resort, I guess, were up top of the hill, and we're walking up the mountain toward the Zillicoa Avenue toward the mountaintop hospital. And in particular, of course, the most striking building there is named Homewood, and it looks like a castle with actual turrets and battlements and so on. It's gray stone. And behind it, on this afternoon that Josh and I were walking up the hill, was one of those incredible winter sunsets. Red, you know, huge red sky behind the battlements of Homewood and the roof lines, the crenellated battlements, and then the roof lines of all the other buildings. It was so striking. And as we're walking up, we're looking at it, and it had just so happened that that very week I was reading a collection of the love letters, early love letters, between Scott and Zelda. And he kept calling her a princess, his princess. And he was very angry with her because after he had met her at the beauty ball in Montgomery, he'd wanted her to stay true to him, you know, while he went to make back to New York and finished his novel and made enough money to marry her. But instead, she was a belle, and she was going out with about eight boys a day in Montgomery, and he was very angry. So he wrote her, and he said angrily, "Now I know why they keep princesses in towers." And she had written back, "Well, it's so nice that you're writing me so many letters, Scott, but I'm so damn tired of hearing that." And suddenly, as I looked up at the at the red sky behind the castle, and remembered about Zelda's death, it all seemed to fit together for me. You know, the horrific fire that had happened right there at Highland Hospital in 1948, and the Southern Princess, the imprisoned Southern Princess, who would be imprisoned, of course, by so many things, including her illness, finally. And I just thought, oh, this is a novel. This is a novel, and I'm going to write it. And I didn't write it for a long time, but I was really, really thinking about it and reading about the Fitzgeralds, reading about early treatments for mental illness, et cetera. And then the novel found its own time, as they always do. And here it is.
Yeah, it's lovely. It sounds like a lovely place from your descriptions of it in the book, which is a little bizarre because the loveliness of the place is somehow contrasted to its being a mental hospital and then to this horrible fire that opens the book. The fire itself doesn't open the book, but you see at the very beginning of the book the news report from the fire itself, and then you move into the story, and then it ends the book, essentially.
Uh-huh. Yes. And I was not sure about starting that way, but so many people, particularly people in North Carolina, know about the fire because it was very, very famous and people know about it. So I thought there's no point in trying to keep it a secret where we're going here.
No, I thought it was very effective. And of course, people who know about Zelda Fitzgerald know about it too. But
exactly.
I would like to talk a little bit about Zelda before we move into the book because,
sure, because
she's kind of the focus of the book, even if she's not the point of view character.
That's right. She is very much a focus of the book, and she's the sort of iconic presence.
Yeah, so we have an international audience who may not be as familiar with Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald as most of the Americans. So, or if they do know about her, they may know about her as the model for Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby. And so they may not have a sense that she was a much more complex character. Daisy is a very washed out, shallow, rich girl. Could you tell us something about her life that people might help people put the novel in context?
Yes, and it is true that Scott, once he met her, did base Daisy Buchanan and other characters and stories and, you know, everybody on her, frankly, and also used some of her own language, famously. But let me say that first, Zelda was both the product and the victim of the Deep South Bell system, which sort of decreed that she spent her teenage years primping and dancing and flirting and fascinating as many boys as possible, often simultaneously. And she was wild. She was zany. She had a great deal of daring and sexual boldness. She was only 17 years old when she met the ambitious young writer, already a writer, Scott Fitzgerald. He was in the Army, and she met him at a dance in Montgomery in the Beauty Ball. He was a soldier stationed nearby that he fell madly in love with her. Everybody fell madly in love with her, and he wanted her to remain true to him while he made enough money for them to get married. She infuriated him by continuing to go out with other boys, etc. But then they did marry 2 years later when she was only 17. So remember, she was largely uneducated. She hadn't been anywhere but Montgomery, Alabama, and she was totally unprepared. She was untraveled, uneducated. She was totally unprepared for the uproarious lifestyle that he was going to throw her into, a wild lifestyle of living uproariously in hotels and rented rooms in several countries and drinking all the time. Drinking was a huge factor. Ring Lardner made the famous remark, Mr. Fitzgerald is a novelist and Mrs. Fitzgerald is a novelty. But he, throughout, was co-opting Zelda's personality and her life and occasionally her actual writing for his own fiction. And at first, she was kind of flattered, but then later, she was even complicit. But later, she made the famous remark, Mr. Fitzgerald, I believe that is how he spells his name. She wrote this in a magazine. Believe that is how he spells his name. Seems to believe that plagiarism begins at home. which is a great remark. So she was brilliant, I have to say. She was wild, she was zany, she was not really educated, but she was brilliant. And her own writing, she wrote all the time, came from her already somewhat disordered mind, and it was wildly imagistic and original, and more like Virginia Woolf, frankly, than anybody else. But he didn't like for her to write, I have to say, or, you know, or put her own name on things. So she did publish a really interesting novel named Save Me the Waltz when she had already been in mental institutions for 2 years, interestingly enough. So she was a writer. She was also very talented dancer. She'd done that when she was young, and then she took up the study of the serious study of the ballet in France too late. She was already 27, and then she would claim later that Scott kept her from doing that either. But actually she was ill. She was very ill, and the throwing herself into dance with such concentration at that age with the famous Madame Egorova really did plunge her into her first hospitalization, from which she never really really recovered. And so the question is, you know, how ill was Zelda? And the answer is very. She had a brilliant but psychotic mind most of the time, a chaotic mind, let us say, and she was really unable to organize these brilliant ideas and images, and she had several horrible episodes of psychosis. I think that today she would probably be classified as bipolar, severely bipolar, rather than schizophrenic. Dementia precox was what they called schizophrenia then. But because, and I say that because she kept coming back. She would be completely psychotic, and then she would write something beautiful. She would, you know, I have read all of her writings, published and unpublished, and they are just remarkable. And also, not only was she a writer and continued dancing, even in the hospital, she was choreographing and dancing. But she was a painter. She was a visual artist. And actually, she painted many of her best paintings at Highland Hospital. So my book is very concerned, I think, with the relationship between creativity and all these various forms and mental illness, because there is, of course, a big relationship. And I'm, you know, I'm very carefully looking at that, I think. And so Zelda was very talented. She was an amazingly talented artist in all these different different realms. But finally, these treatments, the hundreds of shock treatments, which was all these hospitals really had to offer at this time before antipsychotic medication was available, took their own terrible toll. So finally, at the end, she was, you know, she was not able to really think clearly in her final series of paintings are sort of unintelligible, as is her final novel, Caesar's Things, which she wrote. So they're just wild. So they're off into religious dogma and stuff like that. So I guess her marriage was also very toxic for her as well as for Scott, although you've got to say they loved each other, even at the end when he was living in California with Sheila Graham, trying to make a buck from the movies. He was supporting her in style, and they're keeping her in the hospital, sending their daughter to private school, Ethel Walker in Connecticut, and you know, so I think it was what the French call a folie à deux, actually, the craziness of two, where each one sort of encourages and brings out both the worst and the best in each other, and nobody can put on the brakes. So it was a fascinating, fascinating study for me of this couple, and particularly Zelda, because I don't think she's ever gotten her due as a real artist in all the many ways she was such an artist.
I think there are a lot of interesting points there. I mean, first off, especially between manic depression and creativity, there's quite a strong link that's been established scientifically, I think. That
yes.
Especially having a little bit of manic depression, apparently, is a good thing for an artist. Not
absolutely.
Too much, but a little
but,
bit.
You know, because creativity and originality, what is that? That is really depends upon the ability to think, to imagine outside the box a little bit. But the danger is, can you get back?
Right. Can you harness you know? It? Can you put it on the page? Right, exactly.
Yeah, can you put it on the page and then also live a quote-unquote normal life or sort of normal? And it's hard. I mean, so many of our famous artists and writers and so on have had a touch of this or have been flat-out manic depressive.
Right. And it's not uncommon, especially in the past, for them to use alcohol as a way of monitoring.
Oh, right. Right. Absolutely. But I mean, I was interviewing someone whose father had been a waiter at the Grove Park Inn and often served, taking care of stock. He would go up there and live for weeks at a time when he was writing and so on. And when Scott was on the wagon, for instance, that means not drinking gin, he was drinking 30 beers a day.
I remember that from the novel, right?
I took that down right from the horse's mouth. So.
Mm-hmm. So there are two things I don't want to forget. One is the sort of definition of craziness, which at least in some of the characters in your novel seems to be more like you're being a pain to your family or something like that.
Yeah. And this was very interesting to me because I did have access. I mean, I did read about a whole lot of different people who came to Highland Hospital and why they came. And a large number of them, I have to say, were women who had been sort of shipped up there from the deep South where they had failed to fit into their husbands or their families' ideas of how they should behave as proper Southern ladies. And so certainly I knew I had to have a character that would represent that whole group. It was very hard to, in that time, to get away from these social, marital expectations. And so the character that represents, I think, that large group of patients who really were at Highland Hospital of women patients was, why is her name going out of my
Dixie.
Head? Ah, my goodness, huh?
It's Dixie, right?
Of course, Dixie. Yeah, so Dixie was really, was really representative, I think, of something that, will really also of being a belle, because that, those strictures and expectations still apply.
And the other thing I want to get to eventually is the treatments, but we don't want to go too far in before we mention that the main character of this story is Evelina Toussaint of
right.
New Orleans.
And I have to say this has been an issue because people have said, well, since she's such a character, why is Zelda the narrator? And the reason is because that in order to be absolutely, I'm just absolutely determined to be faithful to any real person I put in her novel, and in order to be true to Zelda, I would have to write exactly like Zelda writes, which is, her style wildly imagistic. Things like verb tense and continuity just go right out the window. And she has things like flowers or speaking and hours or marching and trees or singing, and all these things happen in a random order. So often, so it would not only be hard for me to write, it would be hard for you to read. And I did use her style in several places. I had several letters that she'd written that my narrator finds, and a diary entry, and this and that. But I realized that she couldn't be the storyteller, and so I thought, well, who could be my viewpoint character? Because I did want to have a first person viewpoint character who would draw it all together. And finally, I hit upon the idea of a younger patient who would be a sort of a piano prodigy, and she would be an accompanist. Therefore, she would have access, because Highland Hospital was characterized by musical events all the time. This is not made up. They had concerts. They gave musical shows. They had afternoon teas with music. They had every single thing. They were doing, you know, full-scale productions all the time, and somebody has to play the piano. And so I thought, okay, I will have a little pianist who will be my viewpoint character, and she will have access to all these other major people, including, of course, Zelda, who is choreographing for everything, and that's what I'll do. And so then I backtracked and made up such a character and her life and got really interested in her as well, because she is, of course, an artist in her own right, though finally decides rather than being the solo act, you know, the star, that she's the accompanist, which works well for my purposes because she's also the listener to everybody else's stories.
So tell us about Evelina, because she's really not, I mean, she does have some problems that get her sent to Highland, but she's also really in the category of not so much crazy as unwanted.
Yes, she is. Well, Evelina Toussaint, All Saints, I guess is her. Evelina Toussaint is her name, and the French name is because she's from New Orleans, and she is the illegitimate daughter of a fancy lady, an exotic dancer and courtesan there in New Orleans, with whom she shares an apartment. And this beautiful mother of hers, a rich cotton broker, falls in love with her, and he keeps the two of them and sets them up in the apartment and then in a little house and so on, and another baby is born. But things go rapidly downhill when the baby dies, and the mother kills herself, leaving this broker, this very wealthy man, with a little, with Evelina. What to do with Evelina, who is only 12 years old? So he tries taking her into his own home with disastrous results. Evelina stops eating. She starts burning her arms with matches, etc. And somehow this family knows about Highland Hospital, which was, as I say, the place where many Southern families sent daughters and wives they didn't know what to do with, and so she's shipped up to Highland Hospital as a disturbed child and lives there for several years, attracting the attention of Mrs. Carroll, the head of the hospital's wife, who is a famous singer and musician and piano player. She was a concert pianist in Europe herself, and this is all true. And so she takes Evelina under her wing, and Evelina really lives at the hospital and does get better and eventually gets a job on staff. So she's the perfect narrator in many ways. And it's also true that there were many people who were actually living at that hospital, other children who were historical, who were there, again, because the parents, I think, didn't know quite what to do with them, so the Carrolls took them in.
That's great. And she lives there for quite a long time. I mean, there's a couple of years when she's away and she gets married.
Yes, she goes
stuff,
away to the Peabody Institute of Music, and then she has her own little career and a disastrous love affair herself, and, and comes back. And just at the time that, in the months preceding the fire.
But she also has friends there, and we've talked a little bit about Dixie. I think we perhaps should at least mention Jinx. She's quite a character.
Oh, well, Jinx was really interesting to me because, you know, this was the time of all sorts of things were going on in this country. One thing, of course, was lobotomy. Although lobotomies were not actually being done at Highland, still there were a few cases of botched lobotomy and so on there. But it was also the time of eugenics, where girls who were considered to be too promiscuous or whatever were ordered by the court often, or just by their families, to be sterilized. And Jinx is somebody, I did a lot of research into, what happened to girls, say, poorer girls, and it often happened to girls of color as well, who were judged to be promiscuous, who were judged to be too wild, who seemed to be on their own, who were perhaps prostituting themselves, often to make money for their families. Well, they would be sent to these various girls' institutions in North Carolina, in particular, is where I was researching this, and sterilized. And there was a famous institution here named Samarkand that was just horrific in its treatment of the girls and its frequent sterilization. And so I made my character, Jinx, be a girl who had been sent to Samarkand, and she was described as, she in court records, as a, she's based on a real person, as a moral imbecile and sterilized and so on. And so many girls, of course, fell into this category. And so I wanted to have a character who would represent that.
So again, it's looping back into your big question about, in a sense, what is crazy? Because Jinx is also not crazy. I mean, she may be.
Jinx is not crazy. She has been so damaged by her treatment, at the hands of the law and sterilization and this incredible cruelty. I mean, torture, literally, in this girls' school, Samarkand. This is all historic. And, and then sent to live with a horrible distant relative, and the uncle, sexually abuses her. So she's damaged. She's not crazy, but she's really, really damaged by what has happened to her. And it's unclear that she's ever going to be able to not lie, and to be a responsible person. She's just a very damaged person at this, at this point, but very charming. She has her charm too. And, one thing that happens a lot of times when you're in the middle of writing a book, other things will just pop up that seem to fit right in. And when I was researching Jinx and this whole book and had already begun writing from the beginning, I learned from a much older relative on my mother's side of the family. I told her what I was writing about the mental institution. And she said, "Well, are you writing about Catherine?" And I said, "Catherine who?" And she said, "Well, our great aunt, who died in the mental institution in Stanton, Virginia." And I said, "What?" And it turned out in my mother's family from Chincoteague Island, Virginia, there had been a cousin whose parents had both been alcoholic and died. So the cousin came to live in my mother's family somebody had put her into the mental institution for being, quote, oversexed. And then she had died in the mental, she'd been sterilized and she died in the mental institution of the flu in 1919. So I just had this in my, own family and never ever knew it. This type of story. So Jinx is another favorite character here.
So this, one of the things I thought was very interesting is that there is a kind of shift between the early days when Evelina is in Highland Hospital, when it's still being run by the Carrolls, and then later when she goes back, it's been taken over by Duke University. And at least from a modern perspective, it seems like the treatments were more progressive in the earlier period than later when they're doing the insulin shock treatments, and which sounds incredibly dangerous apart from anything else.
Well, I have to say, I think that when it was just Dr. Carroll's sanitarium, it was a more of a humane sort of a place. But after, because once it was taken over by Duke Hospital, there's a whole lot of, real medical, regimens and so on that go into place. But I should say, even when when it was just Dr. Carroll's sanitarium, still, he had some pretty scary treatments that were going on, out of sight, too. And one thing he did, as you move up toward electroshock, which was the most progressive of the shock treatments, you go through insulin shock, he did insulin shock too. But he also, before insulin shot came in, did something really, really scary in the first days, which I there was something called metrazole shock. And before metrazole shock, he was injecting horse blood into a schizophrenic spinal column.
Dear God, and it sounds medieval,
no idea why.
It? It sounds medieval, doesn't it?
I mean, I have no idea why this, I mean, you know, how, but anyway, so there were, you know, many cures seem really benign, like the rest cure, which Evelina undergoes when she first arrives. She's so nervous and thin and so on. And the rest cure is basically sort of just kind of almost swaddling you, wrapping you up and, you know, and kind of sedating you. And you just, every time you wake up, they give you cream of wheat or oatmeal and so on. And you're sort of forced to rest. And I think that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, that one wasn't so bad, right?
I could go with that. But as I say, Dr. Carroll also did what he called a freeze wrap, which was to literally wrap people up, you know, and then and ice them down and, you know, lower their body temperature, which I find, which I think sounds awful. So there were many different things. I think Dr. Carroll's really progressive. He was the first person. I mean, he was one of the first physicians with a, you know, with a notable hospital staff and so on, who was really into what is now called occupational therapy. I mean, just the idea that you shouldn't sit around and be crazy, but you should be doing something. So he had all of his patients who possibly could walking 5 miles a day, doing all sorts of exercise, dance, games, etc., and also maintaining the extensive grounds of the hospital itself. So they were all out gardening for the, you know, kitchen garden, and they were taking care of shrubs and plants and grass and, you know, all of this kind of thing. So all of this was very, and just the idea of a schedule, I think, you know, is always good. And so all this was, and then all the, you know, the dance therapy, the music therapy, all the art, all the painting, woodworking, all of this kind of thing was really very progressive at the time, not to mention the theatricals, which he had going on all the time, and the musical things, which his wife was superintending. I have a most wonderful photograph of Dr. Carroll bounding out of the forest wearing a sort of doublet and tights, and he was in Midsummer Night's Dream. He himself was a character. All the staff were always really interacting, and the townspeople got involved, and they would have dances where the townspeople would come and dance and do things with the patients too. It was sort of conditioning for the outside world again, which Dr. Carroll felt was important. So, you know, historically, he and his methods were very interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. And were you surprised by some of the stuff that you found out?
Oh yeah, I was totally surprised. I was totally surprised by some of these. You know, some of these cures that had gone on. I was totally surprised to find out that as late as 1948, which was the year, actually, of the horrific fire in the book, but as late as 1948, the person who had invented the lobotomies won the Nobel Prize. Did you know that?
No.
Yes, yes. And also, there was a character, I couldn't really work him into my book because lobotomies, as I say, were not done at Highland Hospital, but there was this guy named, this real doctor named Dr. Freeman, who was literally traveling the South during the 1940s in this vehicle that he had specially equipped so that he could just do lobotomies in it. And he sort of invented the transorbital lobotomy, where it's like something like an ice pick goes in at the corner of the eye. And so it's really easily done. And he was traveling the South. And, for instance, if he came to your town, say it was Spartanburg, South Carolina, or some little town in Georgia, you know, doctors there, people there could decide if there was anybody, you know, for whom lobotomy was indicated. And he would do it when he came to your town. And this went on. And this is really true. So there were many things that I found totally surprising. And I was surprised, as I say, by Zelda herself, by the depth and extent of her talent, and also by the attachment, the really strong attachment of Zelda and Scott, their last letters that they exchanged with each other before his death. He died sooner. He died in 1940 in California, and she would not die until 1948. But the regard in which they held each other, that, I mean, that this was the kind of love I was just really surprised. I was surprised by a lot of things when I began writing this book.
It's a really wonderful book. It's beautifully described. There are lots of things that, unfortunately, we're not going to have a chance to get to. Like I hadn't realized until you started off talking that the characters who are in many ways the staff at Highland Hospital, this is another way where you get in people who live in that region that you grew up in.
Yes. Yes, this is another, in a way, this is sort of an extension of all my mountain books. Because, you know, when you have these grand institutions set in the mountains, like the Grove Park Inn and Highland Hospital, well, who's working in the kitchen, you know, and who is making up the beds and cleaning the rooms and doing that? These are mountain people who are coming in to have these jobs. And so I have several of them become very, you know, very major characters in the book, too. And then that lets me look at class, you know, in the mountains, you know, and so on. And it's really the insider-outsider thing, which makes it even more interesting for me. But it's also accurate in that one of those mountain workers in the kitchen was the one who actually set the fire, although this is never conclusively proven.
It adds another dimension to the book, I think, as well. I mean, there's so many different kinds of conflict among the characters and within the characters, because they're all, even if they're not actually crazy, most of the patients have been dubbed crazy, so that gives them something that they have to deal with. But in addition to that, there's this sort of social conflict, which it doesn't ever, well, I mean, in some places it does flare up, but even when it's not flared up, it's sort of there, you know, this economic disparity.
Yeah, it's just Yeah, it was just a situation in which I could really deal with a whole lot of these themes that just fascinate me. I mean, and I was trying to have it all happen, you know, on this kind of continuum of, you know, okay, who's crazy and who's not, you know, and who's to say, finally.
Right.
And it, you know, it is sort of asks the question, you know, the guests on Earth, I mean, who are the guests on Earth? Well, according to the quote that, you know, that's in the book, the title, you know, comes from a letter that Scott Fitzgerald wrote to their daughter, Scotty, and he said, "The insane are always mere guests on Earth, eternal strangers, forever knocking on closed doors, carrying broken decalogues that they cannot read. Forever knocking on closed doors," which is, you know, very sad. I mean, a decalogue would be like the Ten Commandments written on stone.
Right.
And things like, well, okay, something that tells you how to live, and they can't read it. They don't know how to live because their illness is keeping them, you know, outside, and they're homeless, you know, psychologically, symbolically homeless in that way. But what I'm trying to say here, you know, is that, well, but we're all guests on Earth, in a way, and we're only here, you know, for just a little while, and in what ways are we like these people? In what ways are they, you know, are they like us? And, you know, we're all a little bit crazy one way or another, so I just want to think about that, you know, want us all to think about that.
Yeah, you've just answered the question that I haven't asked yet, which is what you would like readers to take away. I think that's probably your answer.
Well, I think,
right?
I would. That's right, and I would even, you know, as I said, I'm especially interested in women and madness and the resonance between art and madness. But I think I really do, having such a family experience myself of life within these institutions, you know, I want to show that very real lives are lived within these illnesses and also within such institutions. And, you know, asylum is a word that means place of shelter, of mm-hmm. refuge, after all, first. And so I just, you know, and finally, I think if this book, what I'd like for people to take away is just, you know, what it's like to be crazy, what it's like to be called crazy, what it's like to be in such places and so on. And I really, and what it's like for the families and also what it's like for the caretakers. And if I could, you know, dedicate it to anybody, it would be to all the caretakers. I think, you know, the families and the friends and the advocates and the mental health professionals, you know, everybody who serves as a host for these, you know, precious guests on earth that are here among us. So this particular story, I think, gave me a way to talk about these things, because I don't think a novel can, you know, you can't have the themes be too strong. I mean, it's not some sort of instruction manual. I think it's more like a prism that you just hold up to the light and you turn it this way and you turn it that way, and maybe it offers a new view into these issues. So that's really what I was wishing that people would take away.
I think that's a lovely way to put it. What are you working on now?
Well, actually, I'm writing a series of, I guess you'd say, vignettes or little essays or something about what I was mentioning earlier, my own growing up in the mountains. About, it's going to be a little book about, I'm pretty much done, actually, about place and memory and stories, the nature of stories. And I have interviewed a lot of people that are involved in it, too. I was other people that are involved as well that I knew or have known. And I'm really spurred on, I have to say, to do that because my hometown has recently been completely destroyed as because it kept flooding. And so as a flood control, you know, as a flood control, flood prevention measure, the whole town has been, you know, eradicated, including my father's dime store where I literally grew up. And the whole town is gone, and the river has been widened there. And what was the downtown is gone, and my parents' own home was just blown up, demolished this past August. And so this is really, I mean, I think we all lose our childhoods. We all lose the scene of our, you know, the scene of our youth. But to have it go in such a dramatic fashion has been really, really galvanizing for me. So it has made me want to write little word pictures of what isn't there anymore, I guess you'd have to say.
Yeah, it must be like a kind of death, really.
That's, yeah,
a death in the family, say.
Yeah, it is a death in the family. It is. And somehow, you know, losing the dime store was just as hard as my parents, you know, as my home, my parents' house and so on. But so I think the name of it is going to be just Dime Store.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, listen, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with Lee Smith, the author of Guests on Earth. You can find out more about her at www.leesmith.com. That's L-E-E-S-M-I-T-H as one word. Like us on Facebook, search for New Books in Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NEWBOOKSHIST FIC. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also visit my blog at http://blog.cpleslie.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. My social media links are under the About Me tab. Goodbye until next month, when I will host another conversation about new books in historical fiction.